So we meet Boaz once more, and this time we meet him at the city gate where he's going through the legal proceedings by which to redeem Naomi's land and to marry Ruth. That's where we're meeting Boaz this morning. In some ways, we have similar customs in the West. Lawful marriages, if you're lawfully married, that required some legal proceedings. If you gain ownership of some property, that also requires some legal proceedings. This is what Boaz has gone to do at the city gate, the courthouse of the ancient world, where these legal proceedings could take place. There was, however, one small snag to Boaz's plan and his legal case. Boaz, remember, has set out to go and redeem Naomi's land and to marry Ruth as a redeemer. He had a legal right to do that. And yet someone else had a stronger case than him. Someone else was first in line to perform the role of a family redeemer. And we discovered this last week when Boaz explained to Ruth, "It is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I." So this is the court case being presented at the city gates. This is the kind of courtroom drama fit for an episode of Suits. Who would lawfully make good on Naomi's land and marry the girl? Would it be the unnamed relative, or would it be Boaz, the worthy man? Now, I don't know about you, but if I knew I could ethically and lawfully come into a bit of family land, I wouldn't turn my nose up at it. I would seriously think about it. I would consider it, and I would see if I had the means to pay the necessary fees and costs to get my hands on the family land. And this is precisely what redeemers like Boaz had to do. When the ancient custom was observed where they could redeem land, it wasn't free land. They didn't just walk into it and get it for no cost. Redeemed land came at a cost. And remember, though Naomi's name appears on the title deed of the land, according to verse 3, her land had long been abandoned and had probably fallen to use by someone else. So a redemption fee, a redemption price was required in order to resolve all the complexities of lawful ownership. Who really had a right to the land? That is what is being settled at the city gates with a redemption price. And so, in verse 3, we discover this is exactly the case that is being heard. Then Boaz said to the redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of this and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know. For there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you." And then that unnamed redeemer said, "I will redeem it." Right from the outset, right at that point in the story, this is where everything hits the proverbial fan. Boaz's good plan appears dead in the water. The hero has suffered a mortal blow. All that we have come to believe and hope for Naomi, that a good and worthy man would restore her fortunes, would marry the girl and live happily ever after, all of that is now slipping through our fingers. Those words of the unnamed redeemer, I will redeem it, is such a letdown. If that's the way the story closes. Just imagine if that's where the story of Ruth ended. It's a massive letdown. But that is not where the story closes. The unnamed Redeemer has not counted the cost. He thought he was simply gaining a bit of land, that he was involved in a simple land sale, but it's not. It was a package deal. The land came with a marriage, and that to a widowed immigrant. You want the land? You have to take the widow as well, and she's an immigrant. Look at verse 5. Boaz said, "The day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance." Now, just as a note here, for those of us, or friends or neighbors, who are jittery about the Bible's language, where it says Ruth is being acquired. Some of us get jittery when the Bible speaks as though Ruth was a piece of property to be owned by someone. A flat-footed reading with our own particular set of cultural sensitivities does mean we have some work to do at understanding what the text means when it says Ruth is being acquired. We have our own cultural sensitivities that we bring to this, and we also often read the Bible quite flat-footed. To acquire someone, at least in this setting in Ruth, was not to own them like property. Rather, if we have followed along with the book of Ruth this far, it has been at pains to explain to us that whoever would acquire Ruth as a wife would be obligated by God to protect, to provide, and to look after her and her mother-in-law. You get a lot, and you have a lot to live up to by acquiring Ruth, the immigrant. She wasn't your property. You had a lot of duty to fulfill, a lot of God-given duty to fulfill. To be acquired, in the words of Christopher Ashe, would be enriching rather than demeaning. So fix that in your minds. To be acquired is to be enriched rather than to experience a demeaning stage of life. And that being so, the unnamed Redeemer pulls out of the deal. Verse 6. Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance." So when this unnamed Redeemer is sitting in the courtroom of the ancient times at the city gates, and he looks at what's on offer, the land, the marriage, all that is required of him, he soon realizes the cost is too great. It is too expensive for him to follow through with this deal. It is too costly. It would mean more mouths to feed, more work to do, and then something that we might overlook. The land itself would never actually really be his. The land will follow the family line of Naomi, not his. The land will follow her family line into the future, not his. It would remain the inheritance of Naomi's descendants. All this is to say that we are meant to understand from this that redemption is a very costly undertaking. You didn't just stroll into it. It was costly to redeem. redemption in the Bible is a costly concept. We can run straight to the gospel with this. When the New Testament writes about Jesus and his work to redeem and acquire for himself a people, it says, "You were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot." Think about this. In order to make you a Christian, if you're a Christian, in order to make you a Christian, God did not sit with cigar in hand, effortlessly signing off pieces of paper to make some spiritual transaction. That's not the scene. It was a costly thing to make you a Christian. It cost the precious blood of Jesus himself. It cost him his life. That's what Ruth's story is foreshadowing for us here in the Old Testament. It shows us by example that redemption is costly. Not everyone is up to the task of performing redemption. It is costly to the one doing the redeeming, but unimaginably enriching to the one receiving the redemption. So redemption in the Bible, it is costly to the one doing the redeeming, but is unimaginably enriching to the recipients of that redemption. So as far as our text is concerned then, the redemption price is something Boaz could and would gladly pay. And then in verses 7 through to 10, we have a number of cultural practices that just seem strange and archaic to us. For instance, in verse 7 it says, "Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to another, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel." Well, you can visualize what's going on there, right? Take off your sandal, give it to someone else. It's strange and it's archaic. But don't let descriptions of ancient practices make you dismissive of the Bible. Don't let its ancient practices make you dismissive of its relevance to contemporary life. Don't fall into the mistake or into the fallacy of chronological snobbery, as C.S. Lewis cautioned us. He said about this kind of snobbery, this kind of chronological snobbery, where we look back at ancient practices that seem old and archaic to us, he said of those, that kind of snobbery, that it is an uncritical acceptance of the intellectual climate common to our own age and the assumption that whatever has gone out of date is on that account discredited. Lewis is simply cautioning us that just because biblical customs seem old and out of fashion doesn't give us the warrant to treat them dismissively. We don't get to just throw them out the window because they don't make a lot of sense to us. They do hold up. They do have a true purpose. We just need to learn that purpose, even if we do not adopt their exact form. I don't know when the last time was you were in the courthouse, but I have never seen someone take off their sandal in order to complete a transaction. But that doesn't mean that the custom is irrelevant. It does have a purpose. We just need to learn the purpose. And in the custom of those days, it seemed that you signed off the legal agreement by swapping sandals publicly. It was a visible testament, much like our signatures are a visible testament, that it is us doing a transaction or making a deal. It is a visible testament transferring the right of redemption from one person to another. Quite visibly, as I hand you the sandal and you hand me yours, we are swapping. We are exchanging the right of redemption from one person to another. And this is where things get really interesting in the story. It's at this moment where things get really, really interesting. Let's look at verse 11 together. Everyone, including the respected elders who adjudicated this case, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman," speaking of Ruth there, "who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." Why is that so interesting? Well, remember, Ruth was a foreigner. She was an immigrant. She's a Moabite, she's not an Israelite. And here, the people of Israel so richly blessed her marriage to Boaz that they would liken her to Rachel and Leah. Remember, Rachel and Leah were mothers to the 12 sons who became the tribal heads of ethnic Israel. They carried a high honor. They were distinguished amongst the women of ethnic Israel. It was a high and great honor indeed to be counted like them. And it is with that in mind that the people of Israel blessed Ruth, a foreigner, an immigrant, to the people of Israel. They would bless her to be in the same group of honored women as Rachel and Leah. One lesson for us here is simply this. The people of God are so well equipped to honor and welcome those who would be classed as ethnic outsiders and foreigners into the family of God. We are so well equipped to do this. We do this because each and every Christian eventually discovers that's exactly who we were at one point or another to the household of God. At one point or another, we were estranged from God. We were once separated from Christ and alienated from his promises. As the scriptures say explicitly, "You who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ." God has been bringing outsiders and foreigners into his family and blessing them with tremendous honor since long ago, as we see in the story of Ruth, the Moabite. We, the Christian church, are therefore so well equipped to extend the same kind of grace we once needed and received to others also. We too are equipped to welcome the foreigner and the outsider into the family of God. Then the final lesson that is so clear in this chapter, especially as it draws to a close, is that the story God is writing in the world is a story of restoration. God is writing a story of restoration. Consider our three main characters, Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. Naomi, remember, left the covenant community, Israel, and then her husband died, and then her two sons died, leaving her a childless widow. She came back to the covenant community, empty and bitter about life. In her own words, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full. and the Lord has brought me back empty. But now, that's what you said in chapter 1. Now look at what her closest friends are saying about her and to her. Her community of friends say, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him." Naomi has come to know that although she was once destitute and alone, she has come to know the care of Boaz. She has come to know God's care for her in Boaz. She has come to know what a true friendship looks like, a true friendship of faithful love. She has come to know what that looks like in Ruth. She is learning. Naomi is learning through all the painful experiences of her life that God is writing a story of restoration for her. Think of Ruth. Having buried her first husband with a lonely, bitter widow as her sole companion, leaving the land and the people that she had known all her life long, in order to make a new home amongst the people of God. What would she find there? How would these people who claim to possess the promises and word of God treat a foreigner like her? Not only did she find the care of Boaz's provision for her daily needs, she found a worthy man for a husband. And once childless, she now had a son, someone who would carry on the family name of Naomi, whom she loved. She too was learning, through all the misery that she has been through in life, about God writing a story of restoration for her also. And all of these stories of restoration are possible because of the Redeemer in the story, Boaz. He's the hinge on which Naomi and Ruth's restoration turned. The point is clear. In biblical imagery, any story of restoration that God would write for you must come by way of a Redeemer. And that Redeemer is Jesus Christ. You must have him to have any certainty that your story will also end up as a story of restoration. You must have him. You must have a Redeemer. And this is not to imply that if we come to Christ, we will receive all this restoration all at once. Christianity is not the promise of your best life now. Though Naomi and Ruth would experience a great deal of restoration in their lives, and they clearly did experience a great deal of restoration, remember, they are living in the days where the judges ruled. None of that has changed. Regarding civics, their political world was still unrestored. It was still a mess. It was still the days in which the judges ruled. Even though Ruth would conceive and have a son in Bethlehem, it would be many generations before one of his descendants would become King David. It would be many more generations still before one of King David's descendants, Jesus, would also be born in that city of Bethlehem. And that Jesus, of whom it is said, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. All of that world was yet unrestored, wasn't it? For all the good that Ruth and Naomi experienced, it didn't remove all the cursedness of the world all at once. And this goes for so much of we experience in our own lives. Much of the good that we receive from the hand of God are anticipatory. They are pointers. The good that you receive from the hand of God, whatever they may be, they are pointers. They anticipate. They tell us, yes, yes, God is writing that story of restoration. Surely He is. But that story is still being written. It hasn't been finished yet. The chapter hasn't ended. We haven't yet reached a happily ever after. The Redeemer will redeem. Good things are coming. Some joys have already been experienced. But whatever measure of restoration we find from Christ in this life is anticipatory restoration. It is not the fullness of the restoration itself. We anticipate with the Scriptures and all God's people a future of delight and restoration when the dwelling place of God is with man. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And He who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I am making all things new. To the thirsty, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment." We long for and we anticipate these things.